In my own sector, investment management, just 9% of UK fund managers are women. In the US, only 184 of 7,000 mutual funds are run by women, according to a study by Aviva Investors. It's a chicken and egg problem. The male-dominated traditional image and reality of the industry makes it hard to attract women and other underrepresented talent. Adding in more women is not at present an option. We'll consider ways to break this cycle in Chapter 6. Unsurprisingly, everyone wants to know whether I think women make better fund managers than men. In my experience, there is often a subtle difference in approach, consistent with all the neuroscience and what might be seen as gender stereotyping. Like me and my daughters, most female investors I have come across do a lot of analysis, researching their ideas thoroughly and consider aspects like the culture of a company. Men tend to be focused on the numbers and quality of the management teams, particularly around the clarity of the CEO's vision and leadership. They also have the courage of their convictions. A balanced, well-directed team seems the ideal, but at present there are too few to test this out. I love the title of one particular study of gender differences in investment behaviour of non-professionals, Boys Will Be Boys, Gender, Overconfidence and Common Stock Investment. Two distinguished behavioural economists, Brad Barber and Terence Odian, analysed over 35,000 American households. They looked at the trading patterns and returns achieved by men and women in their investments over a six-year period. They found that men traded 45% more than women. This is a very significant difference. There are costs involved in trading, which reduce the men's net returns by over 2.6 percentage points a year, compared with trading costs of 1.7 percentage points for the female investors. What explains such a marked difference? Odian and Barber thought it was quite straightforward. Men were overconfident. Confident people are more likely to take action based on their views. Other studies and data suggest that men are more confident than women when it comes to financial matters, so trade more often, but their confidence exceeds their ability to add value. Of course, an individual man may be a brilliant and patient investor. All these studies corroborate what seems intuitive, that it would be useful to have better balance in decision-making, that men and women complement each other. If we can agree that men and women often behave differently in certain respects, then the natural next step is to recognise that we are likely to be motivated in different ways as well. Sending women on assertiveness training courses to try to improve their promotion prospects is likely to prove counterproductive. And the language used in many situations can be unintentionally off-putting to women. A leading business school asked me for help. Just one woman had applied to its advanced executive program that year. A quick glance at the brochure offered an easy explanation. The language used was aggressive, militant, describing how the course would enable participants to dominate and be world-beating. This language wouldn't just discourage women from applying, but a lot of men too. Awards to celebrate women's success can perpetuate the idea that women need to fit in with the male definition of power. In 2016, Forbes' list of the world's 100 most powerful women celebrated the smartest and the toughest female business leaders, entrepreneurs, investors, scientists, philanthropists, and CEOs. The magazine applauded their formidable achievements, which it described as even more so given how hard it can be to establish inroads into industries and job titles traditionally dominated by men. Most of the powerful women I know would wince at being described as tough. We don't want to be tough or formidable, nor do I think it would be particularly helpful to the world, our businesses or our families if we were. Instead, we want to apply our ability to connect with others, to be attuned to their perspective, skills that can be very powerful in their own way. Meanwhile, power dressing is a misnomer if it means adapting men's suits rather than dressing in a way that shows the empowerment of women in our own style. We need a broader definition of power, a new feminine brand of power, rather than just fitting in awkwardly with a masculine concept. If women can be encouraged to be truly women at work, they can make a big difference to the effectiveness of an organisation. In 2011, two American academics, Anita Woolley and Thomas Malone, undertook a study into the collective intelligence of groups. They were looking to establish whether collective intelligence could be predicted and therefore enhanced based on the characteristics of the individual members of the group. they found little correlation between a group's collective intelligence and the individual intelligence of its members measured through IQ tests. This was not unexpected. There is plenty of evidence in the fields of sport and music and in fund management that the best performing teams are not necessarily the groups of the most talented individuals. The finding that did surprise them was an almost linear relationship between performance and the proportion of women in a team. Their experiments suggested that if a group includes more women, its collective intelligence rises, hitting a peak when women comprise around two-thirds of the team. Simply put, teams comprising mostly women perform consistently better. Professor Woolley admitted, "This is not something we expected, and the first time we observed it, we didn't pay much attention to it, until we replicated the finding in different studies." As Woolley and Malone probed further, they found that having more women in a team seems to alter the collective thought processes in a number of beneficial ways, with the groups displaying greater collaboration and the men also changing their behaviour positively. Professor Malone suggested, "Many studies have shown that women tend to score higher on tests of social sensitivity than men do. What is really important to a group's performance is to have people who are high in social sensitivity, whether they are men or women." Studies into the financial performance of companies with more female directors and senior managers corroborate William Malone's theory that mixed gender teams tend to achieve better results. There are a number of these real-world studies, such as those produced by McKinsey, Post and Byron, Credit Suisse, and Societe Generale, analysing companies' empirical results in individual countries, regions, and across the globe. The findings are consistent. Companies with a critical mass of women on their boards tend to perform better than those without. Credit Suisse, for example, looked at 3,000 companies around the world and found that those with more than one woman on their board had returned an average extra 3.7 percentage points a year over those with none in the decade to 2016. To be honest, however, I tend not to rely on this argument when making the business case for more women in leadership positions or on company boards. It's interesting that we still get asked for this, given that there's certainly no business case for having only men in charge. One of the problems with relying too heavily on the empirical data is that inevitably there is much debate over cause and effect. Are the best companies in other respects also better at hiring women and then at creating conditions for them to advance? Or do the women actually create the outperformance? There's a third possibility too, that smart women tend to join already superior companies. It's impossible to prove, but in practical terms, I'm not convinced it really matters. There's probably an element of all three in many situations. I was attracted to join Newton because it had an inclusive culture. I was able to thrive as a result of that culture. And in turn, my feminine management style probably did help the firm to perform well when I became the boss. There was something of a virtuous circle. When it comes to the contribution that women are making to a company, we need to consider the context too, including whether the women are able to be themselves, to provide genuine diversity of thought, or whether they are very similar to the men in terms of education, class, and perspective. In a 30% Club email exchange following the publication of research from Wharton questioning whether board gender diversity improves performance, Rachel Short, business psychologist, summarized it well. The situation is more nuanced than more women equals better performance. Gender diversity is not a quick fix without attention to the external context and internal dynamics of an organization. Gender diversity is good news for stakeholders in terms of corporate governance, strategy formulation, and corporate social responsibility. And 30% is not a nice to have, but a must have critical mass. One or two token women are unlikely to make a positive difference. For all these reasons, I refer to the studies carefully. But with these caveats, the evidence suggests that the presence of more women at the top of a company, not just on the board but running the business day to day, is a useful, positive clue to its prospects. Julia Dawson led the Credit Suisse team that undertook its Gender 3000 research studies. Although we were both working in London, Julia and I first met, as business people so often do, thousands of miles away from our homes in Toronto, Canada, as the two keynote speakers at a conference. Around 250 investment professionals attended the event and were able to contribute through anonymous electronic voting. The moderator asked the audience to consider a statement. Companies with more women in their management teams deliver better financial performance. The audience, a mixed group of men and women, was asked whether they concurred. 93% of them agreed or strongly agreed, and the remaining 7% declared themselves to be neutral. There was not one single person in a blind ballot who disagreed. The immediate follow-up question posed to this group of highly qualified, intelligent investment professionals was whether they took account of the number of women in a management team in their company analysis. Only 25% said they did. This seems irrational. These are smart people. Why pay so little attention to something they say themselves is helpful to returns? One possible, although unsatisfactory, explanation is that many women executives are not running business units, but heading up service areas like human resources and communications. Investors tend to deal with management, the chief executive, the chief financial officer, and heads of business units. So any theory about the importance of women in leadership roles can easily be forgotten in practice. According to the Credit Suisse 2016 study, only a dismal 3.9% of the CEOs of those 3,000 companies in its data set are women. We're working hard to encourage more women to progress to CEO level, see Chapter 8. But as companies adjust to the new power models, as the importance of talent development and connections with a wider range of stakeholders, such as their local community, become recognised, women won't necessarily need to move from their current roles to be seen as influential. Reputation, collective intelligence, and relationships are becoming key to success, so these jobs will come to be viewed as some of the most important in a firm. At present, accounting treatment means that talent is seen as a cost rather than an asset to a firm, an outmoded concept, but one that is proving hard to change because of the practical difficulties in valuing human capital. I have been involved in a number of projects to try to resolve this. Unilever played host to one seminar. Doug Bailey, then Unilever's chief human resources officer, explained that his previous role at the company was as president of Western Europe. He was exasperated that financial analysts continued to ask him more about business matters related to his last job, although he knew that the company's future prospects depended to a large degree on success in his current one. Even after the loudest wake-up call imaginable in the shape of the financial crisis, I think that many people find it hard to think of diversity as core to business success. I've seen how my own efforts have often been regarded as extracurricular rather than part of what it takes to lead a business today. When I was made a dame in the Queen's 2017 birthday honours list, one commentator lamented the lack of captains of industry in the list, described me dismissively as a mother of nine media favourite, and put inverted commas around the citation for services to diversity, as if that wasn't really a thing as far as business is concerned. This perception reflects where we've come from rather than where we're going to. The long history of feminism, racial equality movements, and more recently the LGBTQ plus community's fight against discrimination have mostly been about fairness and about respecting each other and our differences. Fairness and mutual respect are vitally important, but aren't enough of an incentive to make businesses reinvent themselves. We know that, since otherwise we would have solved things by now. To get results, we need to consciously shift the narrative away from any association with political correctness and towards the language of business. Diversity needs a rebrand. To date, even the most committed CEOs are typically disappointed with the rate of progress. In practice, the approach has tended to be to add in special initiatives around the edges of long-established existing practices, mini-makeovers, rather than a top-to-toe overhaul, and as such, destined to disappoint. Today's ways of working are largely built around what made sense in the past, before we had technology, for a narrow group of people in a world where roles were clearly defined and when career paths were linear. For a whole host of reasons, not just to encourage diverse talent. We now need to redevise those working practices so we can work more efficiently, more intelligently, more productively. If we stay on the same path, making modest and often off-target adaptations, we will continue to be disappointed, and not just by a lack of progress on diversity. Organisations will struggle to keep up with other transformations too, and their diverse talent will fall short of fulfilling their potential. Leaning in is demoralising if what we're leaning into doesn't suit us, not because we're prima donnas, but just because we don't operate quite like that. The gender pay gap row in the UK, catalysed by welcome new transparency laws requiring companies with over 250 employees to disclose their gender pay gaps, epitomises the problem. The glaring gaps, all in the same direction between brilliant female presenters and their male peers at the publicly funded BBC, have inevitably prompted recriminations. Sir Philip Hampton, who I have witnessed to be a long-standing champion of gender equality, was roundly criticised for suggesting that women let it happen. He said, "Lots of men have trooped into my office saying they are underpaid, but no woman has ever done that." My experience as a boss has been similar but less stark. A few women have requested pay rises, but far more men, and usually bigger rises too. Sir Philip's comments reveal a gender gap in understanding, however. Women feel less comfortable about asking for pay rises and promotions, but getting us to behave more like men is surely not the answer. Instead, we should be aiming to create organisations where the best talent is recognised and highly valued, whatever shape or form it takes. And if we refuse to change course, we will also continue to make vast and divisive groupthink errors. The financial shocks of 2008 meant that more people, including those in leadership positions, recognised that diversity of perspective was desirable. The 2016 political shocks showed that the theory hadn't yet translated into practice. Chapter 5. Diversity of thought. Welcome until anyone disagrees. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. George Bernard Shaw. On the morning of 9th of November 2016, as the world was digesting the news of Donald Trump's US presidential election victory, a group of business leaders, government officials, and journalists gathered in London at KPMG's Canary Wharf offices. The seminar had been arranged several weeks beforehand, not to discuss the US election result — it seemed no one had considered how that might hijack proceedings — but to share the recommendations of a review into the still very low numbers of female executives at UK companies. Sir Philip Hampton, now chair of pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, and Dame Helen Alexander, who sadly since died, chair of events company UBM, were presenting ideas to help businesses improve the gender balance of their leadership teams. Naturally, the 200 or so attendees were somewhat distracted by the breaking news of Trump's victory. The atmosphere was strained. It felt odd to be discussing women's advancement on a day when the US election outcomes suggested that we might be moving backwards. Not only had Hillary Clinton failed to shatter that final glass ceiling in America, but she lost to a man whose campaign had been rocked by leaked tapes of his offensive remarks about women. The widespread reaction was surprise. Charles Berry, chair of FTSE 250 engineering company Weir Group, was the first to speak on a panel advocating that businesses develop female talent to improve their results. He opened with a telling confession. "Why was I surprised about Brexit, about Trump? Because the inputs to my thinking were not sufficiently diverse." This might have seemed an encouraging admission, but it was also disheartening that Charles, a long-time dedicated supporter of efforts to increase boardroom diversity, had not linked that to the need for more diverse inputs to his thinking. He was far from alone. Just a month beforehand, I suggested to an American friend, a senior businessman, that Trump would win, only to be told I didn't understand US politics and was wrong. But why was it all such a shock? Why hadn't the improvements in governance, including but not limited to greater gender diversity in the boardroom, broadened our thinking enough to consider this outcome a serious possibility? Between 2010 and 2015, 550 new female directors had been appointed to FTSE 350 boards. We had seen good progress in politics too. In the 2015 UK general election, 191 women members of the House of Commons took their seats out of 650. As in the boardroom, progress had been rapid. At this point, a grand total of 450 female MPs had ever been elected in Britain, fewer than the number of men, 459, sitting in that single parliament. We're on a roll. The 2017 general election set a new record, 208 female MPs, 32% of the total. The motivations behind the drive to attract more female politicians are similar to those in the business world: to represent society better, draw on a wider range of perspectives, and to modernise. Yet despite these conscious efforts, the fact that the big 2016 political developments on both sides of the Atlantic were such a shock suggested that little had really changed at the top. Conventional wisdom still prevailed until it was proved wrong. Groupthink remained alive and well. I have come to appreciate that groupthink is very hard to disrupt. In the 1970s, social psychologists Henry Teufel and John Turner explored the concept of social identity, the element of our individual identity and self-esteem that comes from being attached to groups. Rationally, we don't want to self-harm, so we don't tend to undermine our group by pointing out where we might be going wrong. So we make collective mistakes, then lock that particular door after the horse is bolted. Bank boards and directors are therefore now subject to much more scrutiny than before the financial crisis, but in fact many underlying organisational practices continue pretty much as before, as the ongoing scandals reveal. In short, we haven't actually disrupted things very much. Some of the faces around the table may have changed, but there is still an in-group at the top. It's also true that most of the women who join the boardroom are white, affluent, well-educated and middle-aged, yes, like me, just like the men we replaced. A fair and frequent criticism of much of the recent efforts to improve gender equality. There remains much to do to really shake things up, to move beyond the thin veneer of change. I found this out myself ahead of the EU referendum. I had taken the view and said it publicly that Britain would not just survive but be more likely to thrive in the long term if the majority voted to leave. I really wasn't trying to be provocative. I was genuinely anxious that the financial sector, big business leaders and mainstream politicians might be making another groupthink error. Surely the referendum was an opportunity to think carefully about how the world was changing, about Britain's place in that changing world, and the ingredients for future and more evenly distributed success. The conventional wisdom was that staying in the EU was the progressive option, but that narrative did not fit my direct experience. I had seen the EU operating in a remote, command-and-control way on issues as wide-ranging as financial market policy and gender-balanced boards, and ironically being especially bullying about the latter, with Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding being completely unwilling to discuss alternatives to legislation, the opposite of the approach needed in today's world. In my view, the best decisions are those taken closer to where the real asset, person, or community actually is, where there is more likely to be a good understanding of the issues at stake. Distance tends to compound mistakes. After all the focus on the perils of groupthink since the financial crisis, I thought there would at least be room for discussion. We needed thoughtful debate to get closer to the truth. Instead, there was intense pressure, not just on me, but other business leaders who supported Leave, not to say anything at all. One of Irving Yanis's classic symptoms of groupthink. The no platforming at some prestigious universities was especially disturbing. There were plenty of other signs. I attended meetings in the city where blanket dismissiveness was expressed towards voters for not understanding the economy. There was certainly no attempt to work out why the Remain campaign scaremongering wasn't resonating, or to consider that it might even be the wrong approach, both as a means of persuasion, but also perhaps inaccurate as an economic forecast. Instead, the response was to keep on repeating the same message ever more loudly. The experience showed me rather painfully and personally that we had only reached the point where diversity of thought was welcome in theory, much less so in practice. I could see that my view made many people, including friends, feel very uncomfortable and even angry. That was unsettling for all of us. I didn't want to fall out with anyone, but felt disappointed that there was no joining up of the dots, that all those diversity efforts had not really translated into welcoming or even tolerating difference of opinion. There was no license to challenge. In fact, it seemed that many of those running businesses or in policy-making roles had become more distant rather than better connected since the financial crisis, still operating at the top of their pyramids. In contrast, author and businesswoman Margaret Heffernan gave a compelling TED Talk in 2012, Dare to Disagree, where she suggested that in order to think better, we need thinking partners who aren't echo chambers. After the Google Memo episode, that expression may sound familiar. This certainly can make things less comfortable, much less cozy, but that is a price worth paying if it means we get closer to the right answer. Newton's motto, "No one has a monopoly on great ideas, sounds very inclusive, but also demands an element of disagreement in the decision-making process. When I was CEO, I knew things were working well when debates were heated and the sparks flew. It was time to get concerned when everyone agreed with each other. This may seem counterintuitive, but the more complex our issues and problems become, the more robust and multifaceted our thinking needs to be. The only solution is to introduce more genuine challenge, to deliberately give people the license to experiment, to come up with new ideas. In her talk, Margaret Heffernan set out the compelling story of Dr. Alice Stewart. In 1955, this Oxford medical researcher observed a rapid increase in childhood leukemia. Her determination to find out the cause was heightened by the tragedy of her own godchild dying of the disease. Most childhood diseases are more prevalent in lower-income households, which have less access to good medical care. With leukemia, the opposite was true. Dr. Stewart wondered if the cause might lie in the children's prenatal history, so she interviewed the mothers of the children who had died. In what later became known as the Oxford Childhood Cancer Survey, Alice Stewart and her team visited all 203 public health departments around the country to obtain details of every child who had died of leukemia between 1953 and 1955. As part of the survey, a questionnaire was sent to the mothers of these children as well as to the mothers of children in two control groups, children who had died of other cancers and children who were alive and well. Dr. Stewart noticed a strong pattern. Children who had died of any form of cancer before the age of 10 had been x-rayed twice as often in the womb as healthy children. A single x-ray, well within official safety limits, was enough to double the risk of early cancer. The process already sounds rigorous, but the findings were controversial. So Dr. Stewart charged her statistician, George Neal, with coming up with ways to disconfirm the findings. She deliberately gave him license to disagree, and when he couldn't disprove the theory, she was confident that it was correct. Alice Stewart published her findings in 1956 to a hostile reception. Nuclear technology was in the ascendancy, and there were many vested interests in its success. The resistance strengthened Alice Stewart's resolve, but it took 25 years to convince the American and British medical establishments to stop routine x-rays of pregnant women. Vested interests got in the way of intellectual honesty. For several years, I chaired the Eve Appeal, a small but impressive charity that funds innovative research into gynecological cancers. These cancers are often detected at a later stage, and as a result, mortality rates are far worse than for many other cancers. About 40% of the women diagnosed will die of their illness. There has been little improvement in this statistic for many years, with medical breakthroughs proving elusive. The research funded by the Eve Appeal therefore deliberately focuses on wild card ideas. The actual research is just as rigorous as more conventional efforts involving control groups, years of patient study, panels to review the quality of the methodology. But the starting point is the license to experiment, to deliberately challenge conventional wisdom. As I write this, an exciting breakthrough has been announced by the medical team working with the Eve Appeal. An early warning system for four women's cancers is now, finally, within reach. The greatest advances are made when orthodoxies are challenged. In medicine, science, education, philosophy, the arts, and in business too. I have seen that progress is often resisted, that there will always be those in denial. Many people really don't like change, particularly if they perceive it as undermining a situation that is beneficial to them. I have talked about the enlightened founding chairman supporters of the 30% Club. In fact, there were just 7 at the launch, and I received many more protests from those who thought I was interfering, or even, as one chairman told me, destroying British business. Amazing, really, what one woman can do. Several years later, Sir Win Bischoff wrote me a lovely and very thoughtful letter for reflecting on the progress we had made together. I know from personal observation how difficult, wearisome, and often discouraging your efforts and initiatives sometimes were. Wearisome though they were, the protests were the death throes of an outmoded view. Within a few years, we had seen a paradigm shift in the way the issue of diversity on boards was perceived, so women on boards were now expected as part of a new norm. In 2017, I received a rather unusual award from the Financial Times in partnership with steel conglomerate ArcelorMittal. They named me Person of the Year at their Boldness in Business Awards. An FT journalist interviewed me about being bold. She said everyone knew about the triumphs. She wanted to know about things I had done that were bold but had failed. I realised that I couldn't think of any single bold step in business or in life, including having 9 children, that hadn't been something of a failure or at least a struggle at certain points. Success and failure are closely intertwined, all the more so when it comes to creating change. Even just challenging what's accepted would disturb some people, and yet if none of us did that, we would never make any progress at all. This is where you come in, to take advantage of today's window of opportunity, to deliver on the early promise of more democratic, more equal power. We each have a part to play. CEOs, mid-career managers, the next generation of young women and men, as well as their parents and teachers. This is not either or, either women leaning in or businesses fixing the system, but about working together in a joined-up way. It's about creating an ecosystem, an interactive, thriving community. As the saying goes, it takes a village to raise a child and to create gender equality. Chapter 6. How CEOs can break the diversity barrier. If you're a CEO and don't have gender diversity or diversity in general as a top issue, then you've been asleep at the wheel for the last few years. Lord Mervyn Davis. It's hard to find a CEO nowadays who would say that diversity of talent is not important to their business. I'd say that most actually believe it too. The topic is much discussed at leadership levels and features heavily in lists of companies' top strategic priorities. In contrast with 10 or even 5 years ago, I'm rarely asked why it's important, but often asked how to achieve greater and faster progress. The problem is, after a decade or more of reasonably intense focus on the topic, the results have been generally disappointing. We've reached a frustrating impasse in many businesses. The management team is discouraged by limited progress, feeling they have already done a lot through numerous initiatives, while scarce diverse talent has become disillusioned. What's more, the non-diverse majority may be silently resentful about the time and attention devoted to an issue that they still associate more with political correctness than driving results. Diversity fatigue has set in, and yet there's so much more to do. Yet the business reasons for CEOs to master the issue are ever more compelling. Achieving sustained success in the context of multiple transformations is an increasingly complex mission. Simple, manual tasks can be accomplished more easily just by having more people do them. In the Morrissey household, many of us clearing the dinner table gets a rather large job done quickly. In complex situations, say, should Clara apply to art school or university, a successful outcome isn't dependent on the number of people involved, but on whether we apply the best thinking to the problem. The ascendancy of artificial intelligence has broad ramifications, many as yet unknown, but one that we can see coming fast is a changing role for human capital, people. Elements of current jobs that can be performed by an algorithm will increasingly be done by machines, and those that can't will require judgment, foresight, the ability to interpret beyond mere patterns, and creativity. All roads point to the need for business leaders to devise ways of thinking better. Dr. Scott Page is a professor of complex systems, and his work focuses on how organizations can improve their thought processes. In The Difference, How the Power of Diversity Creates Better Groups, Firms, Schools and Societies, he proposes that the answer lies in messy, creative organizations and environments with individuals from vastly different backgrounds and life experiences. Dr. Page suggests that the link between identity diversity, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, socioeconomic background, etc., and diversity of thought is subtle and mysterious, but it's clear that an organization wouldn't want, say, all white men or all Asian women. He states, "No one can claim to predict the sources of inspiration. Nevertheless, all else being equal, we should expect someone different, be their differences in training, experiences, or identity, to be more likely to have that unique experience that leads to the breakthrough." I love the way he sums up the criticality. Diversity should not be a second-order concern, multicolored sprinkles on the cake of ability. it merits equal billing. Julia Hobsbawm is the world's first professor in networking as a visiting professor at London's Cass Business School. In her book, Fully Connected, she suggests that in an unpredictable, less rules-based world, companies that operate more like jazz ensembles than classical orchestras will perform better. Jazz involves spontaneity, improvisation, a degree of letting loose by the individual musician. Yet in a band, the whole comes together harmoniously rather than being a series of sequential performances. The motif seems apt in our more chaotic, fast-evolving world. A business management team needs to play more like jazz musicians to be able to adapt, to be inventive rather than depend on a blueprint, and to create a whole greater than the sum of its parts. CEOs are smart people, attuned to the zeitgeist. Okay, some more so than others. They can see that the diversity dividend is only likely to increase. This is especially obvious when it comes to decision-making roles, where the key ideas are generated, where strategy is devised. The value of diversity may be less obvious at the implementation stage, where cohesion around those ideas is important. In reality, many businesses have the exact opposite of what seems optimal. Lots of diversity at entry level, and much less in the leadership team, even after many years of effort. The problem is that the majority of diversity programs put in place several years ago remain stuck in phase one. They haven't kept pace with the evolving thinking. That's not a criticism of the architects of those efforts. Any great change is unlikely to be accomplished by the first attempt. It's part of the journey towards progress to stop, assess and adjust, or even start afresh. At this point, what's important is for CEOs to recognize that carrying along the same path will not bring their organization closer to the goal of being truly diverse and inclusive. It's not a question of ramping things up. Redoubling off-target efforts won't make them any more effective. One obvious lesson to be learned is that we cannot expect to make progress by simply layering diversity initiatives on top of long-established attitudes and practices. We also need to address the anxiety about positive discrimination head-on. Creating an inclusive workplace means just that. It's not about excluding anyone. The aim is not to get back to where we started, only with women dominating instead of men. Correcting the imbalance that has prevailed for decades, if not centuries, requires a really subtle, nuanced approach, but that's pretty much the opposite of the standard initiatives in the diversity toolkit at many companies today. The most frequently used tactic is compulsory unconscious bias training. It's become a big industry in itself, accounting for a large share of the billions of dollars estimated to be spent on diversity each year by American corporations alone. Many technology companies, struggling with especially poor diversity numbers, have embraced it wholeheartedly. Facebook made its Managing Bias course harder hitting in 2015 and rolled it out to our teams across the world when its diversity numbers around 16% female, 3% Hispanic, and 1% black employees stalled. The company also made the course accessible to others online with every good intention. The problem is there's no evidence that such training works, and good reason to believe it may actually increase animosity towards minority groups. The training itself may convey the idea that managers are part of the problem rather than the path to a solution, while the mandatory aspect causes resentment. Social scientists, and many of the rest of us, have found that people often rebel against rules. Professors Frank Dobbin and Alexandra Kalev are sociologists at Harvard and Tel Aviv universities respectively, and have studied more than 800 companies to gather the empirical evidence to gauge whether diversity programs are in fact increasing diversity. The title of their paper, Why Diversity Programs Fail, gives the game away. The data they have gathered suggests that command and control measures are counterproductive, whereas voluntary measures can be very effective. Professors Dobbin and Kalev give a blunt summary of their findings. Your organization will become less diverse, not more, if you require managers to go on diversity training, try to regulate their hiring and promotions decisions, and put in a legalistic grievance system. The reality is that we cannot instruct people to alter their thought processes and their attitudes. Each of us needs to do that for ourselves. The role business leadership plays is to encourage managers and employees to reach their own conclusion that diversity is good news, both personally and for the company, to create a shared goal. That may sound convoluted, difficult to achieve, wishful thinking even, and perhaps not hard-hitting enough. But I have seen that it can be done, and it works. Once the realization occurs, once people see it for themselves, they start behaving in a more inclusive way, and progress can be rapid, real, and lasting. Nobel Prize-winning psychologists Daniel Kahneman and his frequent collaborator, the late Amos Tversky, have been described as changing the way we think about thinking. Kahneman's seminal work, Thinking Fast and Slow, explains that most of our thinking is done fast, out of necessity, and most of the time our judgments are remarkably sound given how quickly we make them. We use mental shortcuts to function, but that means we are prone to error, bias, and fallacies. To make better decisions, we need to be aware of this tendency and create workarounds, techniques that protect ourselves and others from inevitable biases. Harvard professor Iris Bonnet extrapolates this concept to create gender equality by design. She outlines how businesses can make deliberate process changes to counter biases that stack the odds against women. In the preface to What Works, she explains that in 1970, female musicians comprised only 5% of the top five orchestras in the United States. Today, women are 35% of the total players. Progress wasn't achieved through a gradual realization that women can obviously be great musicians. It was catalyzed by the introduction of blind auditions, first by the Boston Symphony Orchestra and soon followed by others. When players performed behind a curtain or screen, female musicians were 50% more likely to advance to the next round of auditions. That is a dramatic difference. Orchestra directors, in theory only interested in the sound being made, needed a workaround to overcome their gender bias. Professor Bonnet argues that we should focus our energies on changing environments, not mindsets. In my experience, one can lead to the other. I've seen many times in many situations, both at work and at home, that changing something by design can ultimately change attitudes too. In my view, it's important that business leaders aim for both, since piecemeal workarounds can't hope to address every eventuality that arises in companies. Our goal is an evolution that becomes a revolution, where skeptics become enthusiasts and little guidance is ultimately needed because the behaviour comes naturally. You may be dubious, but this is exactly what happened with the 30% Club. A newspaper cartoon captured one inherent conflict for potential supporters. By encouraging the appointment of more female non-executives, men could be diminishing their own post-retirement options. Yet even those who might have lost out in this way came to see that it was in their overall best interests to be supportive. Soon after the launch, I was told that one eminent chairman was disappointed not to have been asked to join, so I started writing to all the FTSE 350 chairs to invite them to become involved. I had quickly learned that handwritten letters are by far the most effective means of eliciting not just a response, but a positive answer. As 350 handwritten letters was too much, I personalised a standard letter, adding notes to tailor the letter to each recipient. This took some time, so I had only made my way down to HA for Hansen in the alphabet when the responses started arriving from the A's and B's. Most were negative, some overtly hostile, so I stopped writing. I didn't fight the dissenters, not my style, or tell them they were wrong, even when they had misunderstood what the 30% Club was about, or what I was asking of them. Yet despite this wave of rejection, membership grew from 7 founding supporters to over 200. There were 2 main drivers. The first was a conscious design change in the recruitment process. 5 of the 30% Club's staunchest supporters, Sir Roger, Sir Wynne, Robert Swannell, Glenn Marino, then chairman of Pearson, and David Cruikshank, then UK, subsequently global, chairman of Deloitte, became a very high-flying recruitment task force, persuading their peers to join them, a much more effective approach than my letters. The second impetus came with the recalcitrant chairs starting to see the benefits from being involved, including signalling that they were modern and progressive. One chairman had been adamant that he did not want to join the 30% Club when I first approached him and was quite dismissive of the idea. 6 months later, he sheepishly and graciously said he had made a mistake and was keen to join. I was delighted, but curious to know what had prompted his conversion. He explained that the commercial real estate company he chaired had been on the verge of signing a joint venture when the sole female non-executive director spoke up, tentatively raising concerns. She suggested there were risks around the deal structure that hadn't been considered. The chairman realized she was right, that he and the rest of the board had been too gung-ho in their enthusiasm to get the deal done. The female director had approached the situation differently, but nearly didn't say anything because it was intimidating being the only woman. The benefits of the 30% club were now very clear, and the chairman made the willing choice to sign up. I heard Professor Dobbin of Why Diversity Programs Fail speak at a diversity forum in Sacramento jointly hosted by the two vast Californian public sector pension funds, CalPERS and CalSTRS. In my own talk earlier at the same conference, I observed that the 30% Club chairman ending up wanting what we wanted, and as a result became very committed advocates for change. Professor Dobbin explained what had happened, although at the time I was unaware that the approach was a known technique. He talked about the art of creating cognitive dissonance. That sounds an arcane concept, but is a familiar feeling to all of us, the uncomfortable inattention when we hold two conflicted thoughts in our mind at the same time. We feel it acutely if we have to debate the side of emotion we disagree with. Many chairmen were initially skeptical about the 30% Club, but as they started to see the positives, they resolved any inner conflict by changing their original view and getting behind the campaign. I could see the penny dropping in certain conversations, second thoughts that had to come from within a chairman's own mind that no amount of coercion could have achieved. Several years afterwards, the wonderful woman who masterminded the 2015 Paris Convention on Climate Change, Christiana Figueres, compared notes with me about our respective campaigns. We agreed that the breakthroughs came when people finally realized that progress was in their own best interests, whether or not they actually believed in it. But the very first step for CEOs, before embarking on the creation of any cognitive dissonance, before even contemplating design changes, is to hold a mirror up to yourself and your organization. You may have been championing diversity for many years, but consider the following completely honestly. 1. Do you have a real strategy around diversity and inclusion, or are the existing efforts a series of tactical measures that may or may not add up to a plan? 2. Do you have the data that forensically shows where the current problems lie? Recruitment, promotion, pay? Do you fully understand the processes around each? For example, does the guidance used by your recruiters to filter job applications automatically, accidentally, favour particular groups? Are there danger zones? For example, do few women get promoted after maternity leave? Are more minorities put at risk of redundancies? Is there pay discrepancy for similar jobs between men and women, or between white employees and ethnic minorities? Again, do you have the data? 3. Are you personally listening to the experiences of both diverse and traditional talent? Do you understand why they feel the way they do? Do you have a mentee or two? Are those from underrepresented groups still outside the inner circle? Have diversity efforts alienated existing traditional talent? Have you made it completely clear that this is not a zero-sum game? That an inclusive culture really doesn't mean swapping those groups feeling excluded or subtly discriminated against? 4. Are you encouraging or coercing involvement? If you are already inviting rather than forcing participation in efforts to improve diversity, have you created easy opportunities for staff at all levels to get involved? Have you created an ecosystem where diverse talent can help change things as well as benefit from those changes? 5. Are your initiatives aimed at changing the whole workplace, or are they based on the hope that a few more women will be encouraged to fit into existing working practices? Are you prepared to innovate, experiment, even revolutionize? Is the default position that roles are open to agile or flexible working? Do you offer returnships? Is it clear that talent will rise to the top, whatever the path taken? 6. Are your goals ambitious enough? Have you made the explicit link between talent and the future growth of your business, not just spoken in vague, cliché terms about people being the company's most important asset? Are some of the smartest people in your business working in human resources reporting directly to you? Do you feel personally engaged? Once you have the answers, don't fight them, work with them. Resist any temptation to tell people where they're wrong. If it's clear that the whole topic of diversity has become charged, that it evokes suspicions of political correctness or resentment, start by dropping the D word. Reframe the agenda as a core business objective and speak entirely in business terms when referring to the goals around talent. for example, the impact you expect to see on profits. In Chapter 1, we saw how an experiment at Newton, where all staff were offered a 4-day working week, helped long-term retention, saving costs that we might have incurred in replacement hires and possible loss of revenues associated with key staff. It also prevented any sense of special treatment for maternity returners wanting a shorter working week. The workplace was better for everyone, not just the women. In all the companies where I have seen great progress, there's been a winning combination of bold ambition, practical design interventions, and skill in motivating people within a clear, defined, well-communicated strategy. Let's look at three areas, by no means an exhaustive list, to get a flavour of how business leaders can encourage genuine enthusiasm for the benefits of diversity. Recruitment. Of course, if a company can't attract sufficient diverse talent at entry level, it's almost impossible to make progress in senior roles. Happily, I've seen instances where great strides have been made in encouraging a much broader range of candidates to apply, even to companies in traditional sectors like banking. Over 5 consecutive summers from 2012 to 2016, I was invited to address financial institution UBS's interns on gender diversity as part of their training program. It was a fascinating experience, made all the more so by the progress I witnessed over that time as UBS dramatically broadened the diversity of the intake. Effectively, the group went from predominantly male, pale, and private school Oxford-educated to gender-balanced and boasting a rainbow of colours, creeds, socioeconomic, and educational backgrounds. The first couple of years, the bank asked me to speak to just the female interns. In 2012, that was an audience of around 60, or 30% of the whole intake. But in 2013, it dropped sharply to just 30, or 15%. I asked what had happened, and the hiring team explained that there were far fewer female applicants and even smaller numbers made it through the hiring process. I suggested they take a good look at the data for any clues that they could then use for design changes, rather than merely hoping for higher interest from women the following year. We also agreed that it might be helpful for me to speak to the whole cohort in future, as it was important that young men entering the industry were conscious of the issues. By the time I spoke in 2016, the audience was 50% female and visibly ethnically and religiously diverse, for example, Sikhs wearing turbans. A woman translated my talk into sign language, as one of the interns was profoundly deaf. White, traditionally educated men were still very much present and now very highly engaged, asking thoughtful questions, and one invited me, and I accepted the invitation, to speak at another co-ed event for students interested in a finance career. I asked the human resources team how they achieved this transformation. They explained that a detailed study of the applications showed that the female students tended to apply later than the men. No one knew why, but instead of disputing the finding or wasting valuable time investigating, the recruitment team simply accepted the need to take this into account. They devised a new approach for accepting candidates, holding back a number of places until applications closed, so there was enough room for promising female students applying near the deadline. At the same time, they had broadened their outreach to more universities, although they still felt there was more work to do here. Overall, the team had made very significant changes in their own long-established process and achieved a real breakthrough. Importantly, they were delighted with the quality of their 2016 interns, and observed that their greater diversity had really made a positive impact on the way they had worked together on assignments. Andy Haldane, chief economist at the Bank of England, gave an insightful speech on diversity in 2016 entitled The Sneetches, after Dr. Seuss's children's story of the same name, a parody of status and discrimination first published in 1961. In his speech, Haldane challenged CEOs to consider whether their recruitment process really did encourage diversity. Andy Haldane's recruitment challenge. There are two candidates for a position, A and B. They do a test based on the attributes useful for the hiring organization. These tests might be state-of-the-art, including all the diverse attributes one could wish for in an organization, cognitive, interpersonal, and experiential skills. In this test, out of 10, candidate A scores 8, and candidate B scores 4. Which one should be hired? The answer is easy. The evidence points strongly to A as the candidate best meeting the requirements for the job. They have quite literally ticked the right boxes. But let's add a twist. What if the answers A gets wrong are the ones B gets right? And what if the questions existing employees get wrong are also the ones B gets right? In other words, what if candidate B brings skills to the organisation which otherwise do not exist? The right recruitment decision for the organisation is then to choose B rather than A. Candidate B adds more to the collective ability of the organisation, even though they are weaker individually. The question is, how often would existing recruitment practices deliver such an outcome? In practice, I think rarely. Individuals are typically judged on the alignment between their skills and those of the existing organisation. It takes quite a leap of faith to choose instead the candidate whose skills are misaligned with the hiring organisation. When it's set out like this, everyone can see that candidate B is the candidate who adds something new to the organisation. I have cited this challenge many times, and on every occasion, those in the room are shocked by how obvious it is, and yet how their own recruitment process would not lead to the right candidate, B, being offered the role. We still think in terms of hiring the best individual, not the best person to complete the team. We need to put the hire, the promotion, and the choice of someone to do a particular task in the context of the whole group. This requires many companies, and that means their CEOs, to tear up their rule book. Hiring is not about finding another one like those you have, but deliberately seeking out difference. It's not something that comes especially easy. I've been guilty of cloning myself, selecting two student interns one summer who were, in many respects, much younger versions of myself. One was even called Helena. We got on really well, of course, but I hadn't intended to make the mistake of hiring echo chambers. So the next year I consciously sought interns with vastly different backgrounds and ways of thinking to my own. I learned as much from them as I hope they did from me. As more recruiters start to grasp this, individuals from underrepresented areas have an obvious advantage, with their differences being inherently valuable rather than an impediment. From mentoring to tutorials. Mentoring is popular in many organisations, and I have seen it being most effective when a two-way relationship develops between mentor and mentee. There's a separate debate about mentoring versus sponsorship, where the sponsor actively champions the more junior person's career, which is fabulous, but it is hard to find a sponsor until you are already quite established. Mentoring is more accessible and usually focused on career advice. The concept can easily be extended to bring diverse, in any sense, pairs together to work on business ideas or problems. As an undergraduate, I benefited from weekly tutorials, a cornerstone of the teaching method at Cambridge and some other universities. Tutorials are not one-way conversations. The pupil or undergraduate writes the essay, of course, and the don critiques it, but the tutorial itself is a discussion where ideas flow both ways. These rich conversations can enlighten both pupil and teacher. The tutorial format can be replicated in a business environment. Regular, scheduled, and frequent, say weekly, dialogues between two employees at different levels of seniority to work on a project or business challenge. In this way, both parties can develop a greater understanding of different points of view and the advantages of listening to each other. In a world of great and rapid transformations, particularly around technology, creating opportunities for senior staff in both age and hierarchy to listen to those closer to the vanguard of change has many benefits besides fostering diversity. One of the 30% Club programs that has had the biggest impact is a cross-company mentoring scheme for mid-career women. It doesn't sound terribly exciting, and when accountancy and consulting firm EY first suggested it, I was doubtful. Surely the world did not need yet another mentoring scheme. In typical 30% Club fashion, we tested out the idea through a pilot involving just 8 companies and 70 people, 35 mentors and 35 mentees. The feedback was illuminating. The male mentors said that the conversations had opened their eyes to the issues women in their own company must be facing, but either didn't have the opportunity to raise or weren't comfortable discussing with colleagues. Male mentors also received some of the most enthusiastic reviews. The first Mentor of the Year award following the class of 2016-17 went to my former colleague Michael Colfontaine, then European Chair of BNY Mellon. The mentees confirmed that they felt able to be more candid in these conversations with someone outside their own firm, and that the advice was less restrained too. The feedback from the fourth cohort shows the positive impact of these frank exchanges. 95% of mentees reported that their confidence as a leader had grown as a result of their mentoring, and 86% of mentors reported that they had gained learning from their mentoring experience. It may be difficult to fully replicate this candor within a business, but tutorials can help build understanding and mutual respect. Give innovative thinkers the stage.